What you heard was a...
The death toll from Israel's attacks on the Gaza Strip jumps to 119 as the regime keeps pounding the besieged territory. Argentinians take to the streets of Buenos Aires in solidarity with Palestinians as Israel intensifies attacks on the Gaza Strip. Also ahead, India reports more than 343,000 new coronavirus cases and a further 4,000 deaths. Thank you for joining us. The Israeli military continues to pound areas across the Gaza Strip with airstrikes and artillery fire. The Palestinian Health Ministry says the death toll from the Israeli attacks on the coastal enclave has reached at least 119. Since the strikes began on Monday, 27 children and 11 women have been killed in Gaza. Over 620 others have been wounded. In a new Israeli raid on a house in the east of the city of Rafah, six members of a single family were killed. Hundreds of Gazans are fleeing from the east and north of the besieged enclave, fearing the regime's raids. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has conducted rocket and drone attacks into Israel in response to the regime's continued strikes, which killed several of its top commanders and dozens of civilians. The movement used a new indigenously produced drone named Shahab to target Israeli troops near the Gaza Strip. Hamas said it also fired a new missile at Ramin Airport in southern Israel, some 220 kilometers from the coastal strip. The Israeli military says over 1,700 rockets have been fired from the besieged territory since Monday. According to Israeli medics, seven people have been killed in those attacks. Meanwhile, Hamas has said that the movement's strategy towards the Israeli regime has changed from defense to offense. A spokesman for the movement's military wing also said there are no red lines when it comes to responding to the Israeli enemy.
If it comes to responding to your aggression and claiming victory for our people and our sanctities, there are no red lines, sacred rules of engagement, or complicated calculations.
Abu Ubaidah warned Israel against continuation of aggression, saying it is easier for Hamas to target Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities than drinking water. The spokesman said the group has launched the largest missile strikes against Israel since the 1948 occupation of Palestine. He said every price that the Palestinian resistance pays is a sacrifice for Al-Aqsa Mosque and occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds. Abu Ubaidah said what distinguishes this battle is the solidarity of the Palestinian people and their unity on the option of resistance. Political commentator Ramzi Baroud says the Israeli Prime Minister did not expect that the resistance movement in Gaza would come to defend occupied Jerusalem al-Quds with such a determination.
Netanyahu actually did not intend initially to go to war against Gaza. And there are two proofs of that. Number one, he wanted to instigate a crisis in Sheikh Jarrah in order for him to humiliate the Palestinians in front of cameras and the media and to rally the crazies, the right-wing Jewish extremist constituency behind him in order for him to gain few political points in the run-up possibly of a fifth elections, or at least to force the other parties to accept a compromise and an emergency government. What he did not anticipate, two things. Number one is that Gaza would actually come to Jerusalem's rescue with such ferocity and such determination. Number two, he did not anticipate that all Palestinians everywhere in Palestine, from Al-Quds to Gaza to the West Bank, and of course to Palestinian communities inside today's are Israel, Al-Lud, Al-Ramla, Umm al-Fahm, and elsewhere. They are all rising in unison, beyond factional lines, beyond ideological lines, beyond religious lines. To the contrary, they are finding that common ground, and they are finally creating that coveted Palestinian unity, not through Hamas and Fatah, but through the Palestinian people themselves.
Now, Argentinians have taken to the streets of the capital, Buenos Aires, to express solidarity with Palestinians as Israel intensifies attacks on the Gaza Strip. Protesters waved Palestinian flags as they gathered near the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires. They called for a stop to what they described as the Zionist aggression in Palestine. The protesters chanted, "Long live the Third Intifada." That's the term used for the Palestinian uprising against the Israeli oppression. People in the Argentinian capital also urged Israelis to get out of Gaza and said the regime is massacring Palestinians. The Buenos Aires rally was part of global protests in support of Palestinians in Gaza. Such demonstrations took place in different cities, from Chicago in the US to Nairobi in Kenya, as well as Beirut in Lebanon. People worldwide also expressed support for the Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, where Israel has intensified its crackdown in recent days. At the same time, some countries, including France and Germany, have warned citizens against holding pro-Palestine rallies. Both states have cited possible violence during the rallies. Yemenis have marked the Eid prayers in front of the United Nations office in the capital, Sana'a, to condemn the continued silence of the international community towards the Saudi blockade on their country. Our correspondent Abdul Latif Al-Washali has more.
After the Eid al-Fitr prayers, Yemenis came together outside the UN office in Yemen's capital Sana'a to restate the demands of the international community to take real measures against the Saudi blockade on Yemen.
Yemenis celebrate the Eid al-Fitr this year amid the continued aggression and blockade, and the sufferings of Yemenis are increasing due to the continued detention of fuel ships by the Saudi-led coalition, which has caused a severe fuel crisis. We regret to see the United Nations and the international community silent towards our suffering.
Protesters slammed Saudi Arabia for its continued detention of oil vessels that has left their country in a desperate struggle to survive amid the harsh shortage of fuel. They said Riyadh has to release their tankers to prove its good intentions for moving towards a political solution.
Piracy acts against Yemeni oil ships are continuing under the leadership of the United States with the participation of the United Nations. We are about to reach the end of the May, and the Saudi coalition has only allowed one ship to enter the country since the beginning of 2021. The United Nations bears full responsibility for the humanitarian situation in Yemen.
Saudi Arabia and its allies imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen since the beginning of the war in March 2015, depriving millions of Yemenis of their basic needs. The United Nations described the situation in the war-torn country as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Yemenis believe that the United Nations bears responsibility for their suffering as it provides the political cover-up for Riyadh and its allies. They say the international community must break its silence and pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the siege from their country.
The United Nations Security Council is set to hold a public session on Sunday to discuss tensions between Israel and the Palestinians. The world body was initially supposed to hold the session on Friday, but the U.S. objected to the plan and caused the delay. Washington had asked for postponing the meeting until Tuesday. Diplomats say they have now reached a compromise over the U.S. objections, and the session will be held on Sunday. The hostilities between Israel and the Palestinians entered their fifth day on Friday with no sign of abating, despite international calls for de-escalation. The International Criminal Court says it will carry out investigations into alleged war crimes in Palestinian territories, even if Israel refrains from cooperation.
I said that these are events that we're looking at very seriously. We are monitoring also very closely. And I remind that investigations have opened, and this The evolution of these events could be something that we will also look at in the course of our investigations. I think this is just to alert people to be not to escalate, to be careful, and to avoid.
The ICC's prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, confirmed that she is following the current escalation of violence in the occupied territories for possible war crimes. She rejected allegations by Israel and the United States that her office is biased against Israel. Tel Aviv and Washington have objected to the ICC's jurisdiction and rejected membership in it. The ICC is investigating the Israeli regime's war crimes during the 2014 Gaza War, after nearly 5 years of preliminary inquiries. Over 2,100 Palestinians were killed in the 7-week Gaza War back then. Turning elsewhere, India's COVID cases have jumped above 24 million as the country struggles hard with a second wave of infections. India's health ministry registered more than 343,000 cases in the last 24 hours. Deaths from COVID-19 rose by 4,000, pushing the total fatalities to over 262,000. India has seen a sharp rise in infections in the past several weeks, causing a severe shortage of hospital beds and oxygen supplies. The surge is partly blamed on a new strain, which the World Health Organization has classified as a variant of global concern. The Indian government has stepped up its vaccination program to curb the surge. However, the campaign faces major challenges, including limited supplies, as well as rules varying from one state to another.
Fear and fury continues to grip the Indian subcontinent as the COVID-19 pandemic ravages the world's second most populous nation. On Wednesday, India posted a highest death toll of more than 4,200, pushing the total fatalities to over 250,000 based on government data. Reports suggest the death rate could be much higher than the government figures. Based on the government data, Wednesday recorded around 350,000 new infections, pushing the overall caseload past 23 million. The second wave of the coronavirus pandemic has unfolded unseen and unheard miseries in this part of the world. But the poor have always been on the forefront. Health experts have described the pandemic as the biggest crisis and a calamity the country has witnessed in centuries. With a population of more than 1.3 billion people, the country's healthcare system collapsed. So did the second wave unravel miseries of unthinkable proportion for its population. The nation continues to struggle with a lack of crematoriums, graveyards, medical staff, and oxygen supplies. The infection has now spread from big cities to the rural parts of the country, raising fears of more devastation. The poor continue to be unseen victims of the pandemic.
The government's help is not sufficient. They gave us 5 kilograms of ration a month. My husband can't find work because there is no work due to lockdown. Our survival is hard, and if this remains for longer, we will die of hunger rather than this virus.
The rural parts of India are also witnessing a surge in cases over the last 2 weeks, raising alarms how the countryside will deal with the crisis due to lack of healthcare. Reports suggest shortage of wood for cremation is forcing rural Indians to dump dead bodies into the Ganges River. Officials are yet to ascertain if they were COVID victims. An ambulance driver outside the hospital in New Delhi says he never witnessed anything like this before.
I have never witnessed such horror in my life. Every day we carry dozens of dead bodies from hospitals to crematoriums. In many instances we are turned away from there because there is no space to cremate. I don't know, but the country is in big trouble, and this can be felt in air because there is a fear in the air.
With the second wave of the pandemic turning lethal, calls are growing for nationwide lockdown and more tough restrictions, but the government is reluctant, saying the complete lockdown should be the last resort. Experts say one more nationwide lockdown will be another blow to India's reeling economy. Prime Minister Modi and his party has been largely criticized for allowing huge religious gatherings and election rallies despite the COVID surge in the country. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Elsewhere, thousands of people take to the streets of the Greek capital to express their opposition to a controversial new labor law. Demonstrators from the Greek Labour Union rally outside the parliament in the central Athens against reforms that Greece's conservative government outlined on Wednesday. The country's labour minister says changes to the laws that date back decades offer more freedom to decide working hours and help tackle exploitation, unpaid overtime and undeclared work, which have fueled a large untaxed grey economy. The opponents, however, maintain that the government's plans will undermine workers' rights and freedoms. The most contentious part of the bill introduces flexibility to the 8-hour work day. Armenia has launched a criminal case against Azerbaijan after accusing the country's forces of violating its territorial integrity. The Armenian Defense Ministry said Azeri armed forces on Thursday carried out a provocation against the country's sovereign territory in a bid to ensure positional advance into border areas. The ministry said the Armenian side stopped the Azeri advance and forced the troops to return to their positions. Azerbaijan rejected the accusation, saying it was enforcing its own border and is committed to easing tensions in the region. The two sides are at odds after the recent deadly clashes over the Nagorno-Karabakh enclave. The conflict resulted in territorial gains for Azerbaijan and was eventually brought to a halt by a Russian-brokered ceasefire. That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The round of JCPOA talks resumed in Vienna Friday. On its eve, that's May the 6th, Press TV learned US and European signatories to the deal are seeking the destruction of Iran's new generation centrifuges in return for a temporary suspension of some of the sanctions related to the nuclear deal or JCPOA. Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, that is. Whereas, by way of the JCPOA, Iran's advanced centrifuges, including IR-4, IR-6 and IR-9 centrifuges, must only be stored away under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, and not destroyed. To Press TV, it's been crystal clear from the onset that the U.S. is steadfast on its stance, which explains our early prediction that the Vienna talks were not going to produce some miracle fruit in record time. The fruit being the revival of the JCPOA by the U.S. re-entering that deal and Iran recommitting to it. Contrary to the nature of talks, both parties came in with pretty fixed demands, and each expecting the other to take the first step or make the first concession. But it was only one party that pulled out of the deal. That was the USA on 8 May 2018. And so, for talks to become as hopeful as positive comments by delegates to Vienna, perhaps the guilty party will have to make some concessions for its crime. For more on where talks are headed and when, stay with me, Leila Faramaizi, on Iran Today. Iran's partners to the deal would like to get results before this country's mid-June presidential elections, and preferably even before that, because an ad hoc agreement struck between Iran and the UN nuclear inspectors ends on 21st May. And if that is not renewed, the UN will have little effective access to Iran's nuclear sites. To Iran, the time frame and a U.S. return to the deal don't matter so much as sanctions relief. Now, how easy that will be, given the many knots former U.S. President Trump created in the chain of sanctions, our guest will comment on. Mr. Khoshchashm is a political expert of current affairs. He joined us by Skype.
It's more a matter of political will by Washington, because the U.S. is not willing to resolve the conflict with Iran. The U.S. strategy has never been a strategy based on conflict resolution. But it's always been a strategy based on containment. So in this framework, the U.S. feels that it needs the sanctions structure. So they try hard to keep as many sanctions as possible and to keep the sanctions structure intact.
The nuclear deal was signed in 2015 between Iran and the P5+1. That's the US, UK, France, Russia and China, plus Germany. It was to lift nuclear-related economic UN sanctions off this country in return for Iran limiting its nuclear program, which it has maintained as peaceful all along. Iran complied, as verified 15 times, no less, by the UN nuclear watchdog, the IAEA. But instead of seeing foreign trade open up to it, Iran saw 3 years of its economy slipping down the road to higher inflation and a lowered value to its currency. And finally, Trump's USA just backed out of the deal in 2018 on May the 8th. Hence, Iran started reversibly scaling back its nuclear commitments on the anniversary of that day. Mr. Zahed is a university professor specializing in history and involved in media work. We got to visit him at the Ministry of Cooperatives, Labor and Social Welfare.
It's a very complicated situation caused by the withdrawal of Trump's administration from the JCPOA. His decision to leave the deal actually has created many problems for both sides, especially for Iran and the EU members of the JCPOA. We were under heavy economic pressure, especially the ordinary people of Iran. Trump's administration believed that the Iranian government will not cease for this anniversary, so they unleashed a maximum pressure campaign against the people of Iran, hoping that the Iranian government will collapse in few months. However, it proved otherwise. We persisted until Trump's political life came to an end.
Having installed more advanced centrifuges is a continuation of Iran's pressure strategy, which was to get Western European parties to the deal to find a way around U.S. sanctions. This goes to show the Europeans didn't succeed or didn't want to succeed. Today, they appear in a rush to get results from the Vienna talks to revive the JCPOA. Question is, do they have the clout to make that happen? Mr. Aberdeen is a Press TV political analyst. He puts the Vienna talks in context with a look at recent Press TV coverage.
What might be Europe's role in sanction lifting and the revival of the JCPOA?
Well, I'm very skeptical about any European role in any big international affair. The European powers are quite toothless, let's face it. And in relation specifically to the JCPOA, they were absolutely toothless because the Americans violated that deal 3 years ago. Europe did absolutely nothing. In fact, Europe tried to do America's bidding by applying pressure on Iran. And they're playing the same spoiler role again. So you know, I personally, as an expert on this issue, I don't attach too much weight to the European powers. I think for me, the more important partners here are Russia and China.
That's why Iran has been paying almost undivided attention to the East. Where the West fails, perhaps Russia and China can do their part in positively concluding talks and perking up the JCPOA.
How effective do you think Russia and China might be actually in the JCPOA revival, sanction lifting, basically?
Unlike Europe, unlike the three European powers, the UK, France and Germany, Russia and China actually have real leverage with the United States. Yeah, there are so many international issues which the US gets connected to Russia and China. Think about Ukraine, think about Crimea, think about energy supplies to Europe, think about Taiwan, think about Hong Kong, think about all the frictions in US-China trade. So US has a lot to worry about in relation to China and Russia. They have leverage over the US, the European powers do not. And of course, Iran is on friendly terms with both Russia and China, so potentially they could provide a good mediating role, especially in terms of stabilizing the deal once the Americans go back into compliance, once they lift all the sanctions.
A country like Iran with nuclear power and ability for enrichment is not as strategically favored by Russia. Russia has been known to withdraw its support last minute. But after all, this country also needs peace in the region. And also I think that in real politics, countries cooperate based on common interests. And surely Iran and Russia have numerous benefits in common. So there is a hope that this time Russia will remain on Iran's side.
I asked for a comment on that comment that Russia has been known to withdraw its support last minute. Might it do so now? And how fatal would that be in the case of the JCPOA?
The Russians are obviously have their own set of national interests, but in terms of the JCPOA, Russia is in favor of it, as far as we know, and Russia wants to reseal the deal. They want the Americans to go back into the deal, and Russia wants these sanctions lifted. So I don't envisage a spoiler role for Russia in this issue.
Be it by Russo-Chinese efforts or its own will, let's imagine the USA back in the deal. Why will it have gotten back? Plenty more questions and answers lined up, but first a quick review of other media outlets. And here's how it looks on the screen. Tehran Times quotes a senior Iranian MP warning delegates from this country not to fall into a trap. Vienna talks to lead to a new deal, warns the MP. A senior Iranian lawmaker has said that the Vienna nuclear talks between Iran and world powers are expected to lead to a new deal, warning the Iranian negotiating team against falling into the American trap. The lawmaker, Alireza Salimi, who is a member of the parliament's presiding board, said the Vienna talks should proceed within the framework of a nuclear law passed by parliament and in accordance with the policies articulated by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The nuclear law, officially called Strategic Action to Lift Sanctions and Protect the Nation's Rights, stipulates that if the remaining parties to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, Germany, France, China, Russia, and the UK, failed to facilitate Iran's oil exports and the return of Iranian oil revenues in 2 months from the date the law passed in Majlis, the Iranian government would be obligated to stop inspections beyond the IAEA safeguards, including the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol, which allows unannounced and intensive inspections of nuclear sites. Mehr News quotes the importance of deadlines, hard as they might be to meet. risk of Vienna talks to increase after May the 21st, says Ulyanov. Russia's permanent representative to the international organizations in Vienna, Mikhail Ulyanov, in a tweet on Sunday, warned that continuation of nuclear talks in Vienna will be intensified after May the 21st. And continuation of negotiations after May 21st and end of Iran's three-month cooperation agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency will face more uncertainty and risks. We have initiated the four rounds of the Vienna talks to bring the JCPOA back to life, said Deputy of European Union Foreign Policy Chief Enrica Mora, who runs the Vienna talks. No deadlines, but as a coordinator, I feel a certain sense of urgency. Time is not on our side. Happy to see that all delegations, including Iran and the US, say they share that sense. Ulyanov quoted Deputy EU Foreign Policy Chief Enrica Mora's tweet on May the 8th. The Financial Tribune takes note of parties' sense of urgency. JCPOA members agree to expedite restoration process. Three expert groups have been set up to work on the sanctions lifting and nuclear implementation measures and the sequence of the steps to be taken by each side. Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, who had arrived in Vienna Thursday, May the 6th, to head the Iranian delegation, held bilateral discussions with Mora ahead of the meeting. He had also met with Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, on Thursday evening. Hard work is ahead of us, and we hope to get a result as soon as possible. But time is a second priority, Araghchi told reporters following his meeting with Grossi. The first priority is care to advance the Iranian nation's interests and ensure the Islamic Republic's explicit demands are met. He said the Iranian delegation will avoid a rush, which could negatively affect the thoroughness of their negotiations, but will not allow the talks to be dragged out for too long either. That'll be it for the news segment, but plenty more of our narrative, so do stay tuned. Envisaging the day problems are resolved, what would be America's motive for getting Iran and itself recommitted and re-entered into the deal? Perhaps it would simply be to waste more of Iran's time and lure it into signing another deal, a JCPOA 2 or JCPOA Plus.
The U.S. needs multiple agreements. It needs the JCPOA as a platform. Once it gets through with this JCPOA, definitely it asks, as Mr. Biden has already acknowledged, they would ask for step two of the JCPOA in order to ensure that Iran's nuclear capabilities have been contained and the growth in this area has fully stopped. And then they would go for rolling it back. But that's not the end. Then they move on to the missile industry and then the regional power, and then God knows when they would stop asking for excessive demands. As long as the strategy is the same, we shouldn't expect the U.S. to stop its excessive demands. That's the purpose and that's the objective of this strategy.
President Biden has pledged to rejoin the nuclear accord. That was, in fact, even one of his keynote presidential winning points. But he has also called for negotiating a longer and stronger deal afterwards to curb Iran's missile program and its support for freedom movements in places such as Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. Fit for presidency and dignified as Joe Biden might be, in contrast to his predecessor, that is exactly why Iran suspects getting into another understanding with the U.S. Although, in a tweet on the latest meeting, Russian representative Mikhail Ulyanov confirmed the JCPOA's joint commission opened a new round of talks on full restoration of the nuclear deal. So anything else would have to follow rather than modify and sully the present deal. Also, U.S. officials have implied any follow-up deal will upgrade to secure mutual interests with Iran. Problem is, Iran has already suffered irreparable destruction to its economy and nuclear program exactly because of a deal that was abused by the flag bearers. And so leveling out the playing field now will not level and even out the two sides' situation and standing, the two sides being Iran versus the US or Iran versus all its JCPOA partners even. We know Westerners see their interests or Israel's interests in scrapping Iran's ballistic missile program and limiting its regional influence, and so they want a JCPOA plus. But Iran will not deliberately disarm itself of basic defenses it has the capability of producing domestically. Also, the region of West Asia is Iran's native neighborhood. Iranians are one of the oldest prominent tribes here, collectively speaking.
Of course, Iran has on many occasions repeatedly said it's not going to negotiate a JCPOA plus. There's not going to be any additional features to this. No one's going to discuss Iran's regional role. Nobody's going to discuss Iran's national defense capabilities, our ballistic missile capability. And these are taboos. These are red lines. They're never, ever going to be discussed with foreign entities under any situation or any condition.
The Vienna talks stretched out long enough to meet the third anniversary of the U.S. pullout from the deal. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif made a note of that on Sunday, May the 8th, in order to direct efforts. He tweeted, "While we are collectively spending efforts to revive the JCPOA in Vienna, it is necessary to remember how this problem began. Trump's USA was governed like a circus, and it breached U.S. commitments to U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231, which the JCPOA rests on." And so, Minister Zarif stressed that U.S. President Joe Biden must now decide whether the United States wishes to continue breaking laws or to be committed to the laws. It is America that needs to accept its responsibilities, not Iran.
After Trump's presidential term came to an end and Biden took over, conditions have changed for both sides. During this presidential campaign, Biden had mentioned that he would return to the JCPOA. On this side of the table, the Iranian government welcomes any attempt that can improve the current unappealing economic situation in the country. All this has led to the negotiations in Vienna, which I believe is promising.
It may sound too obvious to state, but not everyone can or will see the obvious without constant repetition. The Zarif tweet was provoked by words such as a U.S. official's actually saying that reviving the nuclear deal is possible if Iran makes a political decision, to which Iran says it is up to President Joe Biden to make a decision. After all, it was his country that trashed the deal to begin with, triggering an avalanche and then the Vienna talks to put it all right. Frankly, the U.S. itself needs the JCPOA or it wouldn't have signed it under former President Barack Obama, to whom Joe Biden was vice president.
From an American point of view, this deal created stability. If they're really worried about Iran's nuclear program, then this deal addressed their worries. Of course, from our point of view, there's absolutely nothing to worry about because Iran only has a civilian nuclear program. We have a right to nuclear enrichment. We're willing to suspend that right for a specified period, 5-10 years, whatever the deal specifies, in order to create goodwill from the other side. But from our point of view, we couldn't be more clear. We have a right to enrich uranium to whatever level we want, because we know what we're doing it for. It's for civilian purposes. It's for our energy needs. It's for our medical needs, related needs. Now, if the other side feels that this is a worry for them, fine, we can enter into a deal with them. But we have to get the economic benefit of that immediately.
U.S. officials are centering too much on the ifs of Iran's commitment when Iran has actually left no room for confusion. To me, the message seems pretty clear when Iran says it will. It will, without a shadow of a doubt, recommit to the letter of the JCPOA if and when the U.S. verifiably and reliably lifts all sanctions off this country. Iran was committed when it was all Western parties to the deal that let this country and the deal down. Tens of times, at least the U.S. broke its promises tens of times, Iran's leader of the revolution noted in cautioning, sanctions must be removed first. Once we are certain that has been done, we will carry out our commitments. The U.S. is not after accepting the truth through negotiations. Rather, it seeks to impose its false words. The Europeans have also confessed in some private meetings with our officials that Iran is in the right, and they acknowledge our policy that sanctions must be removed first. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei continued.
So this time, it needs Tehran to verify anything that's undertaken by the United States between 3 to 6 months. For example, when it comes to the oil sector, foreign customers should order supplies, and then Iran should be free to send whatever supply it wants, energy supplies, to its customers, especially those in Asia, like the Chinese, Koreans, Japanese, Indians. And then they should send and wire the money back to Iran, and Iran should receive it freely and be free to do whatever it wants with this money.
The leader's declaration came 3 days after an explosive blast at the Natanz enrichment site, which plunged the facility into a blackout and disabled or destroyed hundreds of underground centrifuges used to process uranium into fuel. This sabotage by Israel and maybe partners set Iran vowing to triple its uranium enrichment purity to 60% purity levels. But it did not succeed in hampering the Vienna talks. Iran is determined to wait for results if partners want to produce them. Joe Biden faces a lot of pressure at home for re-entering the deal by lifting sanctions off Iran. But the U.S.'s domestic problems don't concern this country, and Iran is looking to secure guarantees Biden will remain committed to the deal if he re-enters for the full term of his presidency. Because come 2024, Republicans may well take the reins of power again in America.
One of the red lines of Iran's negotiating position, and this is very important, is that Iran has rejected a step-for-step process. Now, this is not to be confused with a step-by-step. Now, if the Americans want to lift sanctions step-by-step, fine. They shouldn't expect any moves from Iran. They can just lift them slowly. Once they've been lifted, verifiably, Iran will go back into full compliance. But what is an absolute no-no is a step-for-step. So they take one step, we take one step. That's been rejected out of hand.
There are some individuals and also groups inside the country who seem to be unsatisfied with the results of the negotiations. But on the other hand, outside of the country, there are many opposing voices here and there. Countries such as Saudi Arabia are worried, and we know that the Israeli regime is doing its best to deviate the negotiations between Iran and the P4+1 from its current path. Also, hardliners, Republicans, and the Tea Party in the US are extremely against any agreements and lifting of sanctions.
For all parties, it's best at this point to make the most of intermediaries and wise men. That's been the intention. And negotiations have been held both at the level of experts and within the working group set up in the previous rounds of the talks in Vienna. Whatever the results now, the JCPOA Commission will reconvene whenever it is necessary.
Well, I think we can safely say the situation is still unclear. You know, sometimes one party comes and says a deal can be struck within a few weeks or is within reach, and then the spokesperson for the American State Department comes and says completely different, pours cold water on that. So quite frankly, I think we're not getting a sufficient amount of clear information.
Previously, Iranian officials had reported progress in the talks. They said the two sides had agreed that the U.S. would lift sanctions on Iran's energy and banking sectors, which are JCPOA-related, in contrast to the 2019 sanctions on persons and entities the U.S. deems terrorist. But what the U.S. agreed was not enough to satisfy the Iranian officials. Iran continues to maintain the U.S. pulled out of the agreement and should therefore lift all economic sanctions before Iran takes any steps to return to compliance with the JCPOA. That's it for today, but there's plenty more coming up, as nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. And it won't be easy, as Iran won't accept any new nuclear demands. Do return to the box at the same times next week and each week after for Press TV's analyses and realistic predictions. Thanks from the whole team, and bye for now.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Quraysh. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, peace be upon him, urged Muslims to supplicate to Allah. He, peace be upon him, said, "Surely Allah hates that people insist on each other for their request. However, he, exalted be his name, loves that for himself. He wants them to ask him for what he has with insistence."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam Baqir alayhi salam has a great, very many, and beautiful, for that matter, conversations and dialogues. We find in one such dialogue between him and his companions, Imam al-Baqir urged his companions to treat people according to the rules of Islamic social conduct. Now, more specifically, within these Islamic rules of social conduct, we find that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam warned his companions and warned the Muslims in general from having certain bad qualities and committing certain abominable deeds. So Imam al-Baqir, in reply to a question from his companion in this dialogue, the question was regarding the poor and the neighbor. And so Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he warned that one of the bad qualities that a person can have is to be rude with the poor and to be cruel with the neighbor. Allahu Akbar. Such a beautiful response to this question in this dialogue from his companion. And Imam Al-Baqir replies that to be rude with poor people is considered an abominable deed. It is considered a bad quality. And it is interesting, but for the most part, people tend to look down upon the poor and disenfranchised and downtrodden. And at times, people might even be rude with the poor. And so here, Imam Al-Baqir, alayhi salam, reminds us that no, one should not be rude, mean, and cruel with the poor. And it is interesting, we find in the Christian and the Jewish tradition about take care of your neighbor, love thy neighbor, as it is very commonly said. Here we find that Imam Al-Baqir says one of the bad qualities and abominable deeds is cruelty with the neighbor. And so we must be very careful, dear friends, dear brothers and sisters, that we should not be cruel with our neighbors. In the traditions of the Holy Prophet, we find that he said to his companions and to his family members that one should take great care of the neighbor. It is interesting, in the language of Farsi and Persian, it is called hamsaye. Ham meaning together, saye meaning shadow. A very beautiful word, which it is saying that me and you, you and I together are under one shade. What a beautiful cultural idiom, if you will, that we are neighbors under one shade, under one roof, and so we must take care of each other. Beautiful words in this dialogue, Imam Al-Baqir.
IB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I want you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Muhammad Al-Baqir alayhi salam.
There are three categories of knowledge. Now, number one is considered to be the ayatul muhkama. You know, they are considered as the signs and the ayat which are muhkam and solid of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Number one. Now, these ayatul muhkama, what does it include exactly? You know, what it contains in it. It's a knowledge. Knowledge of what? Knowledge of ayatul muhkama. Knowledge of the signs of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. What does it really contain within it? Is the discussions of the zat-i muqaddasi haqq. What is the zat of Allah? Yes, we cannot comprehend. So don't, you know, it's off. Just don't think about it because they say don't think about it. Come on, challenge it, question it. What the imams have mentioned about the zat. Do you have any hadith? What the Najul Balagha is saying? How the Saif Sajjadiyah is attending? What the duas are talking about? Think about it when we are reading this dua. When the name of Zat comes, read the translation of it. Look for it. That's how we are supposed to be.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.